From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. On our interfaith calendar, Friday will mark the Hindu festival of Ganesha Chaturthi, the god of prosperity, prudence, and success. The same day, Christians remember the martyrdom of St. John the Baptist. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Anti-gay laws in Nigeria have faced a barrage of criticism from around the world, but have huge support from our Nigerian audience.
Promotion of gay activities in Kenya and also in Africa in general. Within Nairobi and also in Mombasa, gayism.
Homosexuals in Cameroon only live in fear.
Nigeria, Ghana, Uganda.
Earlier this month, President Obama welcomed leaders from across the African continent to the nation's capital for a three-day U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. Although there were a number of pressing issues on the agenda, the sad state of LGBT rights in many of those countries was not publicly addressed. With the leadership position this administration has taken calling for changes in this arena, just how much of a missed opportunity was the summit? Journalist Colin Stewart, who tracks the countries across the globe that criminalize homosexuality on his news site, 76crimes.com, says yes. And he'll be with us later in this show.
Will you stand with us, together with hundreds of other pastors, to reclaim your right to speak freely from the pulpit?
What happens to a country when its leaders do not acknowledge God?
The Republican Party is the natural home for people of faith. This is the place where God's got a home.
Wouldn't it be great if we had a president who was a former Hindu?
With every election cycle, it seems some conservative Christian leaders and activists are pushing harder and harder against the constitutional separation of church and state. Whether by inciting pastors to explicitly endorse candidates from the pulpit, or by agitating for candidates to pander to their own narrow agenda, they're heading down a path that is both divisive and destructive. As we have during past election cycles, Interfaith Alliance has just released its updated election year guide, offering help for citizens subjected to these misguided messages. On this week's show, I'll be talking about problems and solutions with author and journalist Sarah Posner. But first,
it's interesting to me, this emphasis on obedience that we have vis-a-vis God. If you look at the teaching of Jesus, he uses the word obey once. He's always calling us to love and to forgive and to do unto others.
Much has been made of the significantly different tone that Pope Francis has brought to the Vatican, and the messages he has communicated to the church and actually to the whole world. One area, though, that has seemingly been less changed, so far at least, is the hierarchy's relationship to women religious and Catholic women as a whole. When the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which counts among its members 80% of Catholic nuns in the United States, held its recent annual assembly, it seemed that staying out of the headlines was part of the event's agenda. Since being placed under the supervision of American bishops by Pope Benedict in 2012, the LCWR has pursued an ongoing dialogue with the Vatican, but for the most part avoided public confrontation. A noteworthy exception to that policy was the address delivered at the gathering by Sister Elizabeth Johnson, a Fordham professor, prominent theologian, and author of a book strongly criticized by Rome, Quest for the Living God. Dr. Johnson received the LCWR's Outstanding Leadership Award and took the opportunity to speak out strongly on the situation as it now stands. Writer and scholar Patricia Miller covered this in Religion Dispatches magazine, and Patty now joins us on State of Belief Radio. Welcome back, Patty.
Thank you so much, Will.
Who is Sister Elizabeth Johnson, and why are the bishops saying such terrible things about her?
Well, Sister Johnson is a Fordham University professor. She is a very well-respected feminist theologian with many works to her credit. What caught the attention of the Catholic bishops here in the U.S. was her 2011 book, Quest for the Living God, which had the temerity to really try to work out a theology of the meaning of God in a modern context, to bring some of the theological concepts down to earth for people to understand suffering and grace in their day-to-day lives. She also strongly took a feminist perspective, using language that was not necessarily male-oriented to describe some biblical concepts. And those are things that the Catholic bishops generally do not like. So they officially reprimanded her for the book for what they called serious doctrinal problems with the book. As a result, she is somewhat controversial, according to some people in the Catholic Church.
Well, the LCWR leadership has been very restrained in speaking out about the sanctions imposed on them. At least that's my impression. You may want to correct that. But what does it mean that Sister Johnson pull no punches in this acceptance speech?
Well, I think she is really standing up for her fellow sisters. She really praised them for their commitment to an ongoing dialogue with the Vatican, specifically with the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the body within the Vatican that is investigating the LCWR. And so she really, I think, wanted to stand up for her fellow nuns and say, this is what I see as the situation, a profound gap in the meaning of the two different organizations and how they approach Catholicism, really. She said that the sisters have really taken the spirit of Vatican II to heart and that they are really moving away from a very hierarchical center of the church to what she said, which I thought was really lovely language, towards the periphery, towards the areas of the church where people are suffering, with the poor, with the needy, with immigrants. Whereas, by contrast, the all-male hierarchy is stayed in a very kind of top-down, hierarchical model of the church, a model which, you know, notably Pope Francis has criticized. And yet, there seems to have been very little action in trying to nudge these bishops away from that model of being church.
Could you give us an example of the kind of language that the Pope and his colleagues found offensive that you define or describe as just feminist language?
One thing Sister Johnson said was that she has no specific examples of what language they found offensive. Really, her strongest indictment of the hierarchy, both in their criticisms of her and of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, is that they have given them no specific examples, really, of anything that is theologically flawed with what they're saying. She said they raise a multitude of issues in a confused way. They criticize positions that I take that are in accord with the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and in several instances, they report the opposite of what I actually say in order to find fault. So she's really saying no one will tell her or the other sisters really what's wrong. It seems to be a more general problem with the tact they take, which is very different. And she used some very strong language. She said, and this is to quote her, "In my judgment, such carelessness with the truth is unworthy of the teaching office of the bishop." I mean, that is in effect calling them out for, stretching the truth to find fault with her work, which is very harsh language to use against your fellow Catholics.
Do you see a disconnect between the way Pope Francis has been approaching the absolutism of the Benedict era and the way the women's religious continue to be treated in the United States?
Well, it really seems that Pope Francis, on this particular issue, has turned a blind eye to what is happening and what is a very top-down, hierarchical, clerical approach to these nuns. It is certainly within his purview to stop this particular doctrinal assessment of these women. There is also a larger visitation, it's called, of all the women religious orders in the U.S. going on right now under the auspices of the Vatican. And it certainly is within the Pope's authority to halt those or to change the direction of those, what are basically investigations, to make them more collaborative and collegial, which is what the nuns are really trying to model by remaining in dialogue, is that kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
But he really has not told his fellow bishops to kind of tone it down a bit when dealing with the nuns. The cardinal who is overseeing this assessment made a very harsh public assessment of the nuns several months ago in what was seen as a very public dressing down of the nuns. And Pope Francis was silent on that and allowed that to proceed. So it's not really clear how this is in keeping with the model of the church he seems to have put forth in other contexts.
It doesn't seem like that it's feminist language is the problem. It sounds like the language of truth is the problem.
It does very much sound that way. Now, both the LCWR and Sister Johnson have been, in general terms, reprimanded for feminist themes or feminist language. But again, no examples have been given. And so again, it seems when they try to pose that many of the problems that affect women are really humanist problems that come from broader inequalities within the church, the bishops are calling that a feminist issue, when, of course, they're really just seeing it as a human issue and a power issue.
Yeah. Is it correct that future LCWR assemblies will be under more direct control of the supervising bishop?
That is correct. According to the decree put forth by the Vatican, this is something that the sisters have not had a hand in. It was put down upon them. All their future programs, speakers, as well as all their internal documents, any publications they put out, anything they do is now under the direct supervision of a committee of three bishops appointed by the Vatican to oversee them, which, of course, given the traditional power imbalances in the church, it's hard not to see that as just such a blatantly patriarchal move to put a committee of three bishops over the running of every single female religious order in this country who have been autonomous, self-directed orders for hundreds of years.
Patty, where is this going?
That's a really good question, Welton. I don't know if anyone knows where this is going. As you have mentioned, the leadership conference has been very publicity shy about this issue. I think they are genuinely committed to staying the course of dialogue. They are very much trying to model how they would like to be treated by staying in dialogue with the Vatican. Will this come to a confrontation? Will this come to a head at some point? Will they say, no, we're not going to do this or we're not going to do that at some point? No one can really say right now. The one thing I'd like to note, after the meeting that just concluded, the LCWR did reaffirm its commitment to working with the Vatican through these issues, but they also said, it is our deepest hope, and this is a quote from them, to resolve the situation between the LCWR and the CDF in a way that fully honors our commitment. But they also said they want to protect the integrity of the organization. So that suggests there may be a point at which they say, no, we might not do something the Vatican asks. That would really create an open confrontation between the woman religious and the Vatican in a way that really has not been seen since the mid-80s, when a group of nuns signed on to a very provocative statement in the New York Times saying that there was a plurality of Catholic opinion on the morality of abortion. And the Vatican cracked down very hard on the 24 nuns who signed that statement and told them that they would be forced from their orders if they didn't recant. So we may be seeing another open confrontation between the nuns and the Vatican at some point over this issue.
Patricia Miller is the author of the book Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church. Patty's article, Controversial Feminist Theologian Speaks at Nuns' Final Assembly Without Vatican Oversight, appears in Religion Dispatches magazine, a great source for all of us. Her work is frequently published in The Nation, in The Huffington Post, and elsewhere. Patty, it's always good to talk with you, and I thank you for being willing to come with us again today on State of Belief Radio and enlighten us.
Thank you so much, Welton.
Whether it's Pulpit Freedom Sunday, an organized annual effort to defy the IRS prohibition on political endorsements by leaders of tax-exempt churches, or pressure to get candidates to pass a religiously defined litmus test, there's no shortage of misguided efforts to conflate electioneering and religion. In fact, it's kind of become an American hobby. A major election year effort from Interfaith Alliance, though, is a voter guide that helps identify inappropriate attempts to subvert faith in the service of politics. Interfaith Alliance also publishes a candidate guide and a guide for houses of worship. With this year's guides just out, I wanted to talk about some of the problems we're trying to solve with these guides and to talk with a respected journalist who spends a lot of time observing all of this stuff, our friend Sarah Posner. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Glad to be back.
So when I say the term voter guide, what comes to your mind?
The words voter guide immediately provoke an association to the Christian Coalition for me. Those are the voter guides that the Christian Coalition sort of made famous, mm-hmm. that they would distribute in churches, that supposedly in a bipartisan way distinguished the positions of candidates on various issues. But by focusing on particular issues that were at the core of the Christian rights agenda, the voter guides were kind of partisan in that they made it clear to these church-going folk who it was that the Christian Coalition wanted you to vote for.
Right. Maybe it was just an accident, but every time we studied those voter guides, we found that if the questions on hand didn't work to get the right answers to endorse the right candidate, they just changed the questions.
Right.
Well, look, Sarah, the IRS has just agreed in response to a Freedom From Religion Foundation lawsuit to begin enforcing regulations on pulpit politicking. Do you see that as more likely to lead to a reduction of initiatives like Pulpit Freedom Sunday, or instead to a headlong rush towards confrontation on the part of pro-politicking activists?
Well, first, let me say that there's quite a bit of uncertainty about what it was that the IRS agreed to with the FFRF in that lawsuit. Nobody that I have spoken to has actually seen a copy of the supposed settlement agreement in that lawsuit. I've tried to get a copy from FFRF and have been unsuccessful. So we really don't know what it actually says. But let's assume for the sake of argument that the IRS has agreed to once again begin enforcing these rules prohibiting endorsement of candidates from the pulpit. I think for the religious right activists who believe that that is a violation of the pastor's free speech rights and free exercise rights, they will use that as an opportunity to provoke the IRS to get rid of their tax-exempt status and leading to a lawsuit in which they will challenge the rule at the Supreme Court eventually.
And, of course, nobody has ever said that a house of worship can't endorse a candidate. They simply can't endorse a candidate and remain a tax-free organization.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that the way organizations like the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is the organizer of Pulpit Freedom Sunday, the way that they have framed the issue, they've framed it as a free speech issue, a First Amendment issue. But like you say, you know, it's not like the IRS is saying they can't speak, but, you know, there's a certain responsibilities that go along with having the tax-exempt status. And if you violate these rules, you can no longer have your tax-exempt status. It's not a suppression of their speech.
And I want to, just for clarification purposes, say to our listeners that when Interfaith Alliance talks about voter guides, we're not talking about a document intended to tell you for whom you should vote. We offer some counsel about what houses of worship can and cannot do in an election year and stay within the guidelines of the IRS and with the law. And so you're not going to be told who you have to vote for to be a good anything, mm-hmm. but what you need to do to be a good citizen. And
right.
I'm sure, knowing your careful investigative reporting, you know incidents of attempts to inject religion into campaign politics from past cycles, don't you?
Oh, definitely. And I think there are definitely incidents involving churches where they either outright endorsed a candidate or used language that made it very, very clear which candidate they were endorsing. And that included some of the participants in Pulpit Freedom Sunday. The reason why there weren't investigations by the IRS of those incidents was because the IRS has basically placed that whole investigative function on hold as a result of a lawsuit in which the court ordered the IRS to have the proper staff person in place with the proper authority to initiate those investigations. So it's basically this sort of bureaucratic hurdle that they haven't jumped over yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the proponents of pastor endorsements are waiting for the IRS to actually start clamping mm-hmm. down on this so that they can litigate it. As long as the IRS is not doing anything, they don't have anything to fight against,
right?
They're just saying,
yeah.
Oh, the IRS has this rule that prohibits us from doing this to keep our tax exempt status. But the reality is the IRS is not actually going forward with those at this time. Supposedly, this lawsuit that you talked about at the top will change that, but I think that that is far from clear at this point.
Mm. Sarah, is there any chance this just won't be a problem this year?
Ha, ha, ha. No, something I wanted to raise is a recent interview that the Republican Party's new faith outreach director gave to David Brody at the Christian Broadcasting Network.
Mm.
This gentleman's name is Chad Connolly. The RNC recently hired him to be the director of faith engagement. And in this interview, he was talking to Brody about evangelical voter turnout. And I guess Republicans are concerned that there is inadequate evangelical voter turnout in presidential elections. And in the interview, Connolly talks about one of his proudest moments as a Republican was getting to put in, now I'm quoting, the most pro-faith, pro-family, best platform ever in the Republican Party in 2012. And he said, we have nothing to be ashamed of. This is the place where God's got a home. And I just thought that that was astonishing to say that this is the place, this political party is the place where God has a home.
Well, it's also a breakthrough theological insight.
That is true also.
How do we get beyond this? It seems to me that people who are really concerned about the integrity of religion would be concerned about any religion becoming a prostitute to candidates running for public office.
There's this addiction to it. I think part of the problem is because the Republican Party hitched its wagon to having about a third of its base be right-wing evangelical and Catholic voters, it's dependent on those voters to win. It doesn't have another coalition that it can pull together. So because it's dependent on that coalition, and particularly in the primary process, those voters in many early primary states are the bulk of the primary voters. So mm-hmm. in the primary process, the Republican candidates are bending over backwards to appeal to those voters and talk about religion and talk about faith and God. So I think that that's not going to go away anytime soon. I think the Democrats' reaction to that has not been, okay, let's just stop talking about religion in politics. Instead of going down the path of, okay, we're going to draw this clear line where it's okay for a candidate to have their religion as part of their biography, but we're not going to use this as a pander mm-hmm. to voters. I don't think that that's what the Democrats have done. I think that they've over-worried about Republican accusations that they're hostile to faith,
mm-hmm.
and they've overcompensated.
No, I think this is a bipartisan problem. And I want to be clear that I don't mind people being interested in how a campaign affects religion and how religion affects a campaign. One thing we have in our voter guides is five questions that we recommend people ask candidates when they have a chance to do that.
Mm-hmm.
An example is, what are your views on the boundaries between religion and government? Or how will you balance the principles of your faith and your obligation to defend the Constitution, particularly when they come into conflict?
Right. Well, here's a perfect example of an issue of this, you know, what will you do when your religious faith conflicts with a constitutional requirement? This is probably an issue that will come up in the 2016 election, which is, it could be by then that marriage equality is the law of the land. Now, let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the Supreme Court decides that same-sex marriage bans are unconstitutional. And so say you have a Mike Huckabee or a Ted Cruz or any of the other conservative Christian candidates for the Republicans, and what if they were asked that question?
Mm-hmm.
How did they resolve that?
There are other questions that I want us to talk about. We encourage people, for example, to ask, what role will a candidate's faith play in shaping public policy? That's a huge one in relation to the Middle East and some of the things that we're seeing in the international community.
True.
What steps will you take to protect the rights of your constituents, even if they don't hold your particular religious beliefs? Those are the kinds of things we're asking. I've got to ask you one question before we go. What question do you most want to ask any candidate in an election?
I think, you know, because I write about religion, the issues surrounding religion are of great interest to me. And I guess, you know, in a way, with some of these candidates who talk about their religion so much, it's almost like I would want to give them a truth serum to find out, do they really believe these things that they're saying? Or are they just doing it because they think this is what the voters want to hear? Or one of their opponents is tacking to that point of view and they feel like they have to compete with them.
And that raises the question of whether or not in the United States there is enough of that serum even to try. Sarah Posner is a prolific writer at the intersection of religion and politics. She's the author of the book God's Prophets, Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah also hosts a popular show on bloggingheads.tv. Sarah, as always, I appreciate you taking time to be with us. Thanks for, again, being a part of State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton.
Since retiring from a 40-year journalism career, Colin Stewart has devoted himself to the website Erasing 76 Crimes. It's an invaluable resource tracking the state of LGBT rights in the 76 countries around the globe where homosexuality is criminalized. In the past few years, the extreme situation in Uganda has broken into the headlines. We've talked about it on this show over and over and over again. But the situation is dire in 75 other nations, many of which are in Africa. When this issue failed to come up at the recent African Leaders Summit hosted by President Obama, Colin published a rogue's gallery of the various leaders and the policies their governments enforce. And I am very pleased to welcome Colin Stewart to State of Belief Radio. Colin, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
How many African nations and leaders are we talking about?
There are, by my count, 36 countries in Africa out of 55 that have laws against homosexual activity. There were 32 leaders from those countries at the summit.
Were you surprised at the silence about this issue at the summit?
I was. I was surprised and disappointed. I have turned myself into a little less disappointed based on some thinking and tiny bit of evidence that there may be some positive steps behind the scenes.
So it may be that it wasn't discussed deliberately?
Yes, that may be the case. When President Obama went to Africa on a trip last year, he was quite outspoken about the need for change in those laws. And that was not well received, and it was treated as a neo-colonialist Westerner is trying to tell Africans their own business. I think, perhaps, and I hope, that behind the scenes some good work was being done. There's a tiny bit of evidence that that happened. The Ugandan leader who was there, Museveni, since the summit has been a little, sounding a little more flexible. And the Constitutional Court in Uganda changed its schedule for decision-making and issued that decision that overturned the Anti-Homosexuality Act on essentially a technicality on procedural issues just before the summit.
On this show, State of Belief Radio, we've probably talked about Uganda more than any of the other African nations, and we've talked about it from the perspective of what right-wing religious figures have done in that country and the damage that has been done by it. Do you see the same kind of influence in some of the other African countries that we see in Uganda?
Yes, there is a really strong fundamentalist movement in many African countries, Christian and Muslim, and it's deeply rooted in those countries, and visits by foreign evangelists who are homophobic stirs things up more. For example, one of the people at the summit was is Guy Scott, who is vice president in Zambia. When Zambia was in the middle of putting on trial a couple of young men, as well as an AIDS activist who made a statement in favor of decriminalizing homosexuality in Zambia on Zambian television, and when he left the TV studio, he was arrested for endangering public morals. Guy Scott said in an interview that they had to do something. If they hadn't done anything, the evangelicals would have had their skin.
Colin, I'd like for you, if you will, to highlight a couple of other specific countries and the extent of their anti-gay policies, because I'm not sure people always understand just what an extreme situation this is.
Well, Nigeria recently passed a law that was so similar to, and in some ways more extreme than the Ugandan law. That law made it illegal for gay groups to exist and to meet, for anyone who claimed to have a same-sex marriage. Just participating in that was a criminal offense. And there are a number of reports of arrests and some reports of beatings in Nigeria. Zambia, which I also mentioned, was in the middle of a gay scare just a year ago, and the police issued a call to anyone to report suspected homosexuals to police. There, you know, there are countries that persecute gay people. Cameroon does currently and very actively. There are countries where there are laws against homosexual activity, but they don't seem to be enforced very often. There are a few that are seen to be on the brink of moving in a positive direction. Malawi, enforcement of the law there is suspended pending a court ruling on the constitutionality of the law. Then there are a few where there's suggestions that they don't have a law now, but some people want such a law. So the Congo and Kenya are all in that category. They don't really seem close to passing a law, but they have been talking about it.
Colin, why Africa? Why is it so harsh there?
I think it is the fundamentalist background. The British Empire left legacy of anti-gay laws everywhere they were. And so the number of countries that have anti-gay laws, the vast, vast majority of them are either Muslim countries, which have their own Sharia law-based anti-gay provision, about which we don't talk too much because it's much less news coverage of there, but it's certainly happening. You know, like in Lebanon, there have been recently a wave of arrests. India has a law left over from the British Empire. It was suspended by a high court, and then within the last year was reinstated by the Supreme Court. Jamaica is also formerly British Empire and is in the middle of a struggle over whether their anti-gay law should be repealed. It isn't just Africa, but that's where in a number of countries there is some level of press coverage, a deep homophobia in the population, and the laws in effect.
When you say the problem is with fundamentalists, I think many of us think automatically he's talking about Christian fundamentalists, but Muslim fundamentalists are just about exactly where Christian fundamentalists are on this issue. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely true. I mean, and where there's overlap, it is Muslim hardliners aligning with Christian hardliners, as in Uganda, where there's an interfaith task force or council that just was a huge backer of the anti-homosexuality bill, once known, until it was modified, as the Kill the Gays bill.
Right.
And that group just lost a large chunk of American funding because of its position on that bill, and they ended up, having to lay off their entire staff. But that was a Muslim and Christian organization.
I see.
So it is true what you said.
Colin, how can people in the United States generally, and how can the United States government specifically influence change related to these anti-gay policies?
It has to be a combination of things. The United States needs to support local organizations so that this won't be seen as a movement from the gay-dominated United States to impose the gay agenda on Africa, which is how it gets received and described by the repressive forces there. People need to be supportive of the organizations, and in almost every one of these countries, there are organizations that are in favor of basic human rights for LGBT people, and supporting them is a way to do it, and I'm hopeful that some of the work behind the scenes is happening that can, by the U.S. government, that will give a nudge in the progressive direction.
What got you started with 76crimes.com, and what will readers find there?
They will find a range of news about many, many of the countries with these 70, I now say 76 plus, because my current list is about 81. And it's news. Sometimes it is from local newspapers. Sometimes it is, I can often work with local journalists or journalist activists, as I did in Cameroon. Eric Lembembe there wrote 34 articles that we published in English and in French over more than a year. Unfortunately, very sadly, a year ago he was killed, apparently in response to his work. So that's what you will find there. 76crimes.com, and there's a French version too. And how I got started on it, I go to the Episcopal Church. When I was first in California, went to local Episcopal Church, and the priest is the Reverend Albert Ogle, who is a gay activist currently. And after he left the parish ministry, he founded St. Paul's Foundation for International Reconciliation, which works with local groups in many of these countries. And he was in the process then in 2012 of bringing activists to the International AIDS Conference in Washington, D.C. to allow them to make the case that fighting AIDS is not going to be a success if countries are declaring LGBT people as criminals and doctors won't treat them and they're shunned at clinics. So I began working on that effort then and met a lot of these people at the conference and had some level of trust established by working with Father Albert. So I got accepted as a straight ally, and so it's gone from there. I've been able to continue working with many of them and adding new people that I work with in a number of countries, Jamaica and African countries, and some in the...
Colin Stewart brings 40 years of professional journalism experience to his important work at 76crimes.com. Colin, I appreciate you taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Before we go, here's a confession for you, along with the addendum of an observation. Over the past several days, sadness and confusion have interacted with pleasant surprises and signs of hope, each seeking domination. As a person who lived through three decades of the turbulence of the civil rights movement in our nation, viewing the whole scenario from a perspective south of God, recent days have been filled with disturbing mental flashbacks and strong feelings of renewed insecurity and uneasiness. Watching puffs of tear gas in the streets of Ferguson and studying images of angry police officers, strident protesters, and a plethora of faces reflecting fear and disappointment have taken a toll on my spirit, but strengthened my convictions. So much has not changed, I think, in one moment, but nothing is exactly the same, I realize, in the next moment. Social justice movements in our land never have been easy, but they have been predictable, and that hasn't changed, thank God. In the scenes and the shouts emanating from Ferguson, we have seen a near united intolerance for injustice, supported by demonstrations of the healing strength, the vigorous commitment to nonviolence in sharp contrast to the occasional sickening failure of bullying tactics disguised as law enforcement rightfully rejected by almost everybody. Anytime injustice occurs, there is noise. That is as it should be. Injustice can't be observed without protest in a caring society. The truth is that maybe things have been too quiet too long. So quiet for so long that some of us lost sight of legal battles not yet won, discrimination that has gone without challenges, and a demand for justice that will not be quieted. Most everybody understands the need for a demonstrable, attention-grabbing protest. In fact, this time around, the vast majority of law enforcement officers have sought to protect protests as a basic civil right and, for some, a moral necessity. Clergy in Ferguson are being praised for their leadership in condemning apparent injustices while not descending into the realm of violence as if that is justified by a crisis. Members of the clergy, black and white, fundamentalists and liberals, have worked together to prove that righteous anger does not have to degenerate into riotous behavior. I hope you've noted that the religious leaders who've gathered in Ferguson as advocates of peaceful change have come from the vast diversity of faith traditions in our nation rather than exclusively from one or two progressive denominations. Through the tears that we've shed over this tragedy, we have been able to see clearly how diversity is a source of strength and how working together is a necessity. Listen, friends, don't hear me today as an optimistic Pollyanna. Neither the title nor the spirit fits my character. I am as impatient about the need for positive change as anybody. I am well aware of what we're up against. 80% of African Americans think not enough attention is being devoted to what happens in Ferguson, and at the same time, 47% of white Americans think too much time and attention are being devoted to this story. America, we do have a problem. I know the challenge that we face, and I realize it is not easy. But amid a horrible situation in Ferguson, Missouri, something hopeful, something promising has happened. Social justice is receiving attention as a vital ingredient in authentic religion. People, a lot of people, are working together, not against each other. In Ferguson, in this civil rights crisis, the minority is on the wrong side of history and of morality. Bigots are without honor. Political leaders have to note that the most votes are on the side of equality, fairness, and justice. We still have a chance for this nation to live up to and to lean into its founding vision in which all people, have access to justice, and more people, maybe more people than ever before, even have access to mercy. Keep strong, my friends. Don't give up. We cannot look away from the bad and the dangerous, but it is equally important that occasionally we gaze at the good and say, thank you. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We love your affirmation. We benefit from your money. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear listeners all across this nation who tell us that they can't find this kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us. You can do that throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. We have a listener line you can call. The number is 202-681-4246. We always encourage you to tell other people about this show and encourage them to listen and then to get with you and talk about what they heard. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And for goodness sakes, join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.